Accession number 12274, real 4.
Fancourt, real 4. You were just telling me about your time in 36-37 on the Neptune in regard to the Spanish Civil War.
Yes. Yes. The Royal Navy was distributed around the various ports of Spain, North Spain and in the Mediterranean. Assisting people in distress who wanted to be evacuated. We evacuated some people from Malaga, I think. There wasn't much action. It was the, what's it called, a near an agreement, wasn't it, or something, and we were supposed to be neutrals. The Italians and the Germans were supporting Franco and the communists and supporting the communists in Spain. But it was a tedious time. You couldn't go ashore, and we really didn't do anything, as far as I can see, except be there.
What kind of refugees were there that you took off in Malaga and these other places?
Oh, they were mostly the upper-class people. Who the British consul was still in Malaga, and he got in touch with these better class people who were supporting Franco, and he did a sort of Scarlet Pimpernel act, bringing the people down clandestinely, and came more. We sent boats in and brought off our little parties here and there. We did quite a lot along that coast. We did one or two, and two or three other cruisers did the same thing. And in the end, of course, it all sort of petered out when Franco won the war. And we were a jib at the time. And when the war was over, we came home, and we were glad to be rid of that one. It wasn't a very nice assignment, really.
Was there any threat to you at all at any time?
No, not at all, no. No, I don't think anybody got threatened at all. Nobody shot at us, no. We then got... we came home, and the Neptune was allocated to the South African station to take over from one of the cruisers out there. So after I'd been in the ship just a year, then we paid off, and she recommissioned, and they wouldn't send me out there because I was only due for another year of general service. I wanted the fleet Aram again. So I had a year or so on to fill in, and they sent me to command a little sloop in the Red Sea, called the Red Sea Sloop, called the Western, where I cruised around the Red Sea, and it was a great place to be as a commander in command. Nobody liked the Red Sea, and no admiral ever came near you. And you were fated wherever you went to all these nice little ports and things like Port Sudan and Aden and Suez and up the Gulf of Aqaba and so on. People were awfully kind to us. There were not a lot of people there, but they loved the Navy there. And my ship's company were happy. We very good lot of chaps, and we did a lot of boating and sailing and fishing and asking around generally and showing the flag. And she was a happy little ship. And I was very sorry to leave her, but after a year there, I was taken out to go back to the Admiralty.
What are your memories of the declaration of war?
What?
The declaration of war.
Well, I was at the Admiralty of the declaration of war. I went back to the Admiralty as soon as the Western paid off, and I was at the Admiralty 38. And I was able to, in fact, I was on leave when war declared. No, I wasn't on leave. I was about to go on leave, and I think we stopped it. And the war came September the, what, 3rd. And...
how did you feel about it?
How did we feel about it? I don't know, really. It had been hotting up on, and one was rather expected it, but you didn't make a plan for it. You didn't expect it to the extent that you started to, at least I didn't, moving your family around and all that kind of business. But there had been so much disturbance and tribulation all those interwar years that it was no more nor less than what had been going on all the time, you see. I mean, all this Hitler business, and before that it was Mediterranean business, and before that as Mr. Kummel, before that was some down in China. I mean, it was all a state of unbalanced, really. The world was so unbalanced. And when 39 came, I thought, well, I say, perhaps we should get away with this one sort of thing. In the Admiralty, we were doing all we could to get the fleet air arm on an even keel, because the Admiralty had just been given complete control of the thing, and the RAF influence had been finally removed. It left us pioneers and the thing very much with a newborn baby, which was hadn't got the necessary facilities to grow quickly. That's what we needed, and we had to get on with it. And I was in the personnel department at Admiralty, and we were scratching it around trying to collect young men to learn to fly, and all the maintenance side, and the fitters, and the riggers, and the lot. We had a proper old pot mess to put right as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, the war came before we'd half done the job. But anyway, we got something going. But as I say, I was personnel, and hadn't got anybody to point to anything anywhere, really. We were so short-handed, you see. The RAF were taking their chaps away, quite rightly, because they were wanted, and the expanding of the Air Force was going on exactly the same way, and they were short of everything. In fact, it was a very tricky period. But I didn't like being the Admiralty at all. I wanted to get back to flying or ship or, say, get on the war. And I was in personnel, and I was lucky in a way that an opportunity arose in the spring of 1940. In fact, I very nearly went to the Glorious, because the captain of the Glorious saw me in London in April. He said, Fanny, he always called me Fanny, Fanny, I want you to come to the Glorious. You must be my commander flying. I can't stand my men I've got there now. I must have you. And I said, well, I can't. I'm the Admiralty. And he said...
this was Doyley Hughes,
isn't it? This is Doyley Hughes. And Doyle said, well, I'll get you out. Funny chap, Doyle. He was a very determined character. I'll get you to the Glorious, you see. So I went back, left it to him, and nothing happened. He went off to Norway, and he made a bit of a mess there. And in due course, he lost the Glorious and the whole outfit. And as they say, once again, I missed the boat. I missed the boat.
How would you come to know Doyley Hughes?
Well, you commanded the Courageous when I was a squadron commander. He was executive commander of the Courageous.
What kind of a chap was he?
Oh, Doyley. I was very fond of him, but I'm a funny sort of bloke. I think I'd rather get on with these rather roguey chaps, and my training with Bertram Bannerman, I think, really, behind it all. I got on very well. He liked me, and I liked him, and he had tons of guts and go in him, you know, and he was a naughty chap, though. He could be naughty, but...
How could he be naughty?
A lot of us could be naughty, you know. Oh, I don't know. He chucked the Navy at one time and went back to... manage the estate of the old admiral retired, who got the estate down in Wimborne. But he was taken back to the Navy after a year or two. Anyway, that's all. It's a minor point, really. But I was fond of Doyle. But he made an awful ass for himself in the end. And he lost a lot of good chaps, too. It was terrible. No, I was lucky there. I went off to Lee-on-the-Solent eventually. I took command of the training unit down at Lee-on-the-Solent just before the Battle of Britain. We were there in May. I went there in May 1914. We were there for 3 months, training observers and training pilots and various things there. We had a hodgepodge outfit. But I think we did a useful job. We got a lot of people through various courses and things. And then we were assaulted by the Stukas, the fighter bombers, Junkers 87s.
Can you describe that in detail?
Yeah, of course I will. they were very, very good dive bombers, the Junkers 87s. They carried a 1,000-pound bomb, twice the size of bomb that we had in our dive bombers, and they got over there, were about 3,000 feet. They dived up to the vertical like this, and they pulled out, and they let go of this buddy-gate thing about 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet, and they nearly always got a hit. The ships did all the damage to ships around Cyprus and all that, and the Greek islands and that, and later in the war, they did a hell of a lot of damage to the Navy. But they wiped us out pretty well. I was the control tower, and two of these fellows came down, and they put a 1,000-pound bomb just there, where that Acer tree is, and another one the other side, and the old control tower came down with a run. It was, well, built in a way to a brick thing.
It was just a few yards away.
Yeah, but the explosion, it was, I think they bored down at least 10 feet into solid ground, 10 feet, and the explosion went plop like that, and I think it sort of hits the control tower's dancing blow. You can't tell how these things happen. But anyway, we unfortunately had a slit trench outside with some Marines, because we were expecting invasion, you see, at the time. We all tried to defend ourselves, barbed wire and all that. And we lost 8 or 10 Marines in that. But people in the control times, my crew, myself, my operations officer, and one or two other people, we got out. We crawled out through the rubble, and Stukas flew away, and we had to clear up the mess. But I had to go to hospital a day or two later because this explosion burst an eardrum, and I burst my eardrum, and I was in hospital at Haslev for the remainder of that crucial part of the Battle of Britain, and I didn't get out till end of September, early October, in due course that year I got promoted captain, and I was sent to command the air station up in the Orkneys, Hatston, which is a little air station we made in the early days of the war. And it was a very nice station. They did a lot of good work there. Squadrons from there bombed the one or two cruisers in the Norwegian campaign. In fact, they sank one cruiser, one of our fighter bomber squadrons. And I was there training and fleet support and all kinds of things, any old thing we did there. The chief incident there was when I was there was our reconnaissance that we arranged to when the Bismarck sailed and was located in the Norwegian fjord, Bergen, and by the RAF, who did a very fine photographic reconnaissance with a Spitfire. Then the weather closed down, and it was essential to find out whether this ship had sailed. And they couldn't find out because the RAF couldn't get in. It was only a Spitfire, and they couldn't get over there without any navigation or anything else. So we had the bright idea at Hatstone to send in a twin-engine Maryland aircraft we had there, which we used for training purposes. And I sent my commander over there, a fellow called Rotherham, who was a very good naval observer, had been, and he was a first-class chap, and a very good two-and-a-half RMVR pilot I had who flew the Maryland. And they went off with their crew, and they flew around Bergen in a thick fog. I don't know how they managed to do it, but they did. And they found the ships had gone. There was no ship there. They were engaged, heavily engaged by flak and that, but it was, as I say, they were lucky not to get shot down, but they weren't. And they got back, and we made a signal to the commander-in-chief of the Home Fleet, and he got the information he wanted. The ship wasn't there. Therefore, he must start all the fleet dispositions from that moment. So we did a great service to him, and we all got duly rewarded, medals and mentions and God knows what. Rather overdid the medals, I think, but anyway, it was an error on the right side. And off they went, and well, you heard the Bismarck thing has been written about many, many times before, but that was our contribution there from Hatston, which was very important. And then we had the Americans there too. We had the first American carrier came over to the fleet, and the Wasp, and she was required to fly Spitfires into Malta, so she had to disembark all her squadrons with me at Hatston. Why then was honorary command, I suppose, of six American squadrons. And a very good lot they were, too. I got on very well with them. And we had quite a good time there. I landed on their carrier, which they liked that, the squadrons did, because their captain didn't fly. And they were very pleased there that I landed on their carrier, you see, and in my little Gladiator I had there. And the squadrons were, medical squadrons, were, they didn't like their captain very much. And they were delighted that I sort of, you know, got one to windward of him by landing on his ship. So they gave me marks for that. And it was a good effort, as a matter of fact, because captains didn't fly on carriers in those days. Most of them given up that sort of thing. And then the Wasp came back and they took the squadrons away, and I settled down to my home normal routine in the Orkneys, which was a lot of hard work, but a very nice spirit, lots to do. And I think we were pretty good station, really.
Now, I think that you were involved in 1942 with the North Africa
landings. Oh, yes, I was, yes. After I left Hatston, I was sent to the Admiralty for a short time, much to my annoyance, again. I couldn't get out of this by the Admiralty once I got into it, apparently. But they would have me back for the summer of 1942, it was. And damn nuisance was too. However, they said their problems all right. They said, I wanted a ship, you see. I mean, I'd been ashore too long. And they said, all right, we get another chap. You stay there 4 or 5 months. And I did. And they did. A chap did come along. They're a nice fellow, believe me. And I was on the list of appointments for somewhere else. And the North African landings were just blowing up at the time. Operation Torch, it was called. This was this landing, you know, that came from America, and it came from all around the coast, and they were going to land at Iran, and at Algiers and on the Atlantic coast. I don't know the name of the place now. I was a spare captain at the moment, waiting for a ship to go to, and I was sent for by the second sea lord, I suppose it was, and his naval assistant, and told I was got to take charge of a portion of Operation Torch. And when I went to the Admiral to find out what the portion was, it was a madcap scheme of sending in two destroyers and an American regiment, about 500 or 600 Americans, into Algiers, and another one into Oran, which in Oran was to be, there were a couple of cutters there, American cutters, who were going to take them in. And the big idea was that you should make a frontal assault into these places. It was laid on at the last minute, entirely because at that time Madagascar had just been taken by a combined force, and the French had been forced out of Madagascar, which was rather sort of boy's job, really, compared to the North Africa affair. But a destroyer and some Marines had gone into the entrance of the harbour at Madagascar, Diego Suarez, and had gone ashore and was taken the town. It was really quite an unusual event. It was my Admiral at Torch had heard about this. He said, oh, we'll do this at Algiers and Iran, you see. That's how it came about. And there was no time to train the force, there was no time to do anything. It was laid on in the most absurdly inadequate training. That's the thing. Inadequate training is the word. And I didn't know the destroyers had just come off Atlantic convoys, both of them, Keppel and Brooke, and Malcolm and Brooke. And they were suddenly told to go to Belfast and get rid of this thing. I was suddenly told to go and see this American colonel who'd just arrived from America, he's in Northern Ireland. And we were told to mark in this adventure, which was, in the end, it didn't do any good, and it ended in some partial disaster, major disaster in Iran. At Algiers, we did get in. I was in the Brook, and I had half these troops to land there, and the Keppel never got in because she was hit on the way in, and the captain lost the way, and they got in the mud, whatever. I don't know what happened, I've forgotten. But anyway, we did get in the Brook, but not till dawn. And we went alongside one of the jetties there, and we disembarked these Americans, who sort of swanned off on their own. And we hadn't been engaged very much. There's a bit of shooting going on. But then they seemed to get the range of us, and I think they must have been howitzers, I think, but they were dropping right close around us. So I said to my captain in 2.5 striping, I think we better shift berth. I think they've got our range. So he very cleverly handled the ship and took it out of this berth. We went across the other side, and we went alongside there. And then they started to shoot us up there. So we had a small party of engineers who their job was to stop the Frenchmen scuttling ships in the harbour. Well, what were they supposed to go down and look and see if there were any scuttling charges and that sort of thing? It was a pretty hopeless task, really. And anyway, I decided that things weren't good enough. We were either going to blow up there with all our depth charges and torpedoes and things and make a hell of a boo in the harbour, which really wasn't a very sensible thing to do, because we wanted to use the harbour. once the French had been shoved out. So I decided to make the recall signal. It was four hoots on the hoot or whatever it was, because they were falling pretty close to us, these shells, all the time, and I didn't want to lose the brook or blow the brook up. So I said to our gallant captain, round we go, skipper, out we go, and we'll get out. And we turned round and steamed out of the harbour. We left the Yanks ashore, which is their job anyway, they evacuate them anyway, and off we went. And we got heavily engaged going out. There were two forts on either side, and they were shot up. They shot us up quite a bit. Not big stuff, but we were hit three or four times. We had dust casualties and that sort of thing. And ultimately, we got out. But we did nothing, really, except making nuisance of ourselves. And the whole adventure, in my view, was deplorably organized and should never have taken place. At Oran, they lost both their cutters. They were both sunk and a lot of casualties. It was a bad do.
But the brook survived.
I got the brook out. But very unfortunately, we are rather underestimated our damage, and we were withdrawing towards Gibraltar, and in the night, and she made too much water, and we evacuated her for the night, intending to go back aboard in the morning and get her towed in, and she sank in the night. It was rather sad. In point of fact, I made a mistake, I think, by not anchoring at once. Immediately we got out and sorted it out, but we kept going, and we did the wrong thing.
What was the American commander of the American forces like?
He was a fat, jolly chap. Most unlikely sort of. He was a real tough commander sort of job. You see, there they were. He was a nice, jolly fella. We took him out in the Sheffield from Belfast. We were on board the Sheffield for a fortnight, and I messed with him and talked with him and chatted with him. He was a jolly, jolly Middle West chap from Minnesota. They were Minnesota Regiment. They were Norwegians, largely.
Did they impress you?
No. Well, they were a young training unit. They hadn't been to war at all, and they'd never seen anything. They hadn't been trained properly. They'd been sitting in Northern Ireland in the rain for about a month. And suddenly begin an assignment like that is, my view, it wasn't on at all, but I was only a minor cog in the whole idea. But it was a bad decision. Let's take it, let's face it. And you do make bad decisions in war. They aren't in. Anyway, what were their 500 Yanks? They were all consumable. The destroyers were old destroyers, and nobody might have been much of it. I think I might as well. Why allocate two good destroyers? We're very short of that sort of craft. It's the worst time of the war on escorts, and the Battle of the Atlantic was jolly well nearly lost then. We wasted two good destroyers on escort duty for a silly venture like that. I mean, if you take a hindsight view of it, it was thoroughly wrong. But anyway, I didn't get killed, but we got very near this.